KBCC podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering an online hybrid doctorate of education in organizational leadership in West LA with attendance only twice per term. gsep.pepperdine.edu.
From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take 2. I'm A. Martinez. Happy 5th of July to you. Hope you're enjoying the long holiday weekend. Now, for us, of course, the news never stops. Coming up, we'll get into the latest wrinkle with the 2020 census and the citizenship question. Will it or won't it be added? We're going to get to that in about 15 minutes. First, though, it's State of Affairs, our weekly peek at politics in the Golden State. Now, considering that surfing is the official sport of California, it might make some sense that Senator Kamala Harris continues to ride the wave of her debate performance last week. She surged to second place in many national polls, putting pressure on the current leader, Joe Biden. Former vice president may be wondering if being labeled a frontrunner since before he even announced his run meant having to wear that big, giant political bullseye as well. We're going to get into that and more with Jack Pitney, the Roy P. Crocker Professor of Politics at Claremont McKenna College. Hello, Jack.
Good afternoon.
All right. It's probably fair to say that of all the Democratic presidential candidates, Joe Biden is the one who is politically close to the center. Now, it's that centrist label that wins election, Biden told CNN today. He says all you have to do is look at last November's congressional races.
In the general election fights, who won? Mainstream Democrats who are very progressive on social issues and very strong on education, health care. Look, my North Star is the middle class. When the middle class does well, everybody does well.
Wondering, Jack, how do we know how true that really is? When I look at California, about progressive as a state can get, yet at the convention last month for the Democratic Party, voters chose establishment Democrat Rusty Hicks to lead the party over the much more left-leaning Kimberly Ellis.
You have two faces to the Democratic Party, and it's embodied in our two senators. You have Kamala Harris, who is very much identified with more progressive wing of the party, though some progressives say that she's a bit too cautious. You have Dianne Feinstein, who is much more identified with a more moderate wing of the party. But here's the thing. If you look at the roll call votes, they vote almost identically. It's more a matter of emphasis and more a matter of an overt willingness to work with the other side. And of course, that's something that Biden has gotten into a bit of trouble with, talking about his willingness in the 1970s to work with segregationists. But those are, those tendencies in the Democratic Party are very real. And which is dominant, we're going to get a test of that during the nomination contest.
Now, when it comes to things such as Medicare for all, decriminalizing border crossings, free college, forgiving college loan debt, all of which seemingly right now are the litmus tests for how progressive someone is. Biden, he tends to poll lower, but he says he's not alone in his stance.
What I've seen around the country is the vast majority of Democrats are where I am on the issues. Mm-hmm. It's center left. That's where I am. Where it's not is way left.
Jack, it seems like it's either one of two things. Either Biden is really, really in tune to a quieter slice of the Democratic Party, or he is way, way behind in terms of where the party is going. Which one do you think it is?
I think that's a great way to phrase it, because if you look at the polls of all Democrats, people who identify with the Democrat Party, lean Democratic, Biden has a case. But if you look at the people who show up in primaries, the people who are active in the party, those folks are much more progressive. So Biden's challenge is to make sure that the more marginal, more quieter Democrats actually show up to vote. And that's going to take some doing.
This tug of war seems to be going on in the last year, year and a half. And it just seems like one week, one side is winning the tug of war, the next week, the other side.
That's right. And this is something that's been going on for many, many years in the Democratic Party. The embodiment of the more practical wing of the Democratic Party, of course, was Bill Clinton. And nowadays, the stands that Bill Clinton took during the 1990s, tough on crime, pro-death penalty, pro-incarceration, are toxic in the Democratic Party. So that indicates that the more progressive wing of the party has risen in strength. Now, whether it's strong enough to dominate, again, we'll have to wait and see.
Now, the one thing that seems most Democrats agree on is that whoever winds up being the person to square off against Donald Trump has to be a fighter. But Biden makes the case that just like in the sport of boxing, styles make fights.
The role of a president is to persuade, not just go out and fight. If they want someone with a clenched fist, bare knuckle fight, closed hand, closed heart, they got one of those guys right now. That's not me. I have been pretty darn good at bringing people together.
And that's the key question, Jack, right? The Democrats are pondering who to send against the president. Do they want someone like Biden, who describes himself in that way, or do they want someone along the lines of Kamala Harris, the way she showed that she's a fighter, questioning William Barr and also questioning Biden himself in the debate?
Yeah, everybody in the Democratic Party is going to emphasize how different they are from Donald Trump. But what kind of difference is what the Democratic nomination contest is going to be about? As we just heard, Joe Biden is casting himself as a practical problem solver, somebody who can bring people together. Kamala Harris is styling herself as the prosecutor, somebody who can fight just as hard and counter Trump on the field of battle. Two different ways of going at it, but the one thing they all agree on, they don't want to be Donald Trump.
Yeah, and speaking of Harris as the prosecutor, Biden admitted in that interview with CNN that he was not prepared for the way Harris came after him in the last debate last week. And Wednesday in Iowa, Harris doubled down on her prosecutorial skills as a way to go after the president, calling Trump a predator living in the White House.
When we look at this campaign and we look at the task before us, it will be to successfully prosecute the case against four more years of Donald Trump, and I am prepared to do that.
Now, the other side of that coin is that despite describing herself as a progressive prosecutor, both as San Francisco's DA and California's attorney general, she has critics who say her record is too mixed for her to use that label. For example, she opposed the death penalty in a case involving the murder of a police officer, but when an Orange County judge ruled the death penalty to be unconstitutional, she appealed. Jack, candidates always talk about their views evolving. How will Kamala Harris try to square her record, especially as it relates to voters of color?
With difficulty.
Yeah.
And I've been thinking about this. Kamala Harris reminds me of a certain kind of student, somebody who is a star in speech and debate, who's brilliant in making rhetorical flourishes. But when you sit down and carefully ask them questions about the substance of the issues, they have a tougher time. Mm. And we've seen that with Kamala Harris about health care. Just this past week, she went after Joe Biden on busing. But then she talked about her own views on busing under questioning. Her views are really pretty much the same as Biden's.
Wow.
So that's going to be a challenge for her. She has to sit down with her folks and decide exactly where her stands are, and she needs to stick to them. Otherwise, she's going to give ammunition to her critics, both in the Democratic Party and if she's on the ticket in the fall.
Now, another possible hurdle for Kamala Harris could be about money. She and her husband reported an income of nearly $2 million last year, all while campaigning on lifting up the working class and lower income people. It's a question Bernie Sanders and Joe Biden have had to answer as well. Now, it obviously takes a lot of money to run for president, but is being a candidate who earns a lot exclusively a Democratic issue? Because, Jack, clearly it isn't something that GOP voters seem to have too much of a problem with.
Yeah, this is something that she has to worry about in terms of criticism from progressive publications. Obviously, if she were on the ticket in the fall of 2020, Republicans would go after her. But Democrats in the past have picked affluent candidates, too. Not only Franklin Roosevelt and John Kennedy, but John Kerry through his wife, one of the richest people in the country. But she has to talk about her background, and that's why her discussion of growing up in Oakland, leaving aside the busing part of it, is an appealing part of her story.
Now, when it comes to Kamala Harris's campaign, last week's debates really seemed to give her a boost after a time when it appeared that she was running in place. The big question, Jack, is what is she going to do to keep that momentum going? That's what everyone seems to be wondering about her.
Unique selling proposition on the issues. She has to make the big offer to Democrats. Exactly what is she going to do that not only distinguishes her from the Republicans, but from other Democrats? It's not just enough to throw punches at the front runner. She has to give Democrats a reason to vote for her.
Jack Pitney is the Roy P. Crocker Professor of Politics at Claremont McKenna College. Jack, have a great weekend.
Thank you.
All right, now to something a lot of us experienced here in L.A. A series of quakes have rattled Southern California since yesterday. Now, it started with one that was 6.4 in magnitude. That one rumbled close to Ridgecrest, California, about 110 miles north of downtown. And some of you might have woken up early this morning to a strong aftershock that measured 5.4. But in between all that shaking, do you know if you're prepared for the worst?
You know, why not? You never know what's going to happen, you know. So I want to be ready. For my kids and my grandkids.
That's Christina Martinez, who was buying an emergency survival kit this morning at the store SOS Survival Products in Van Nuys. Store owner Jeff Edelstein says business has been busier than normal.
What the quake does is it's a reminder for people to get prepared. So some people are buying pre-made earthquake kits because they realize, oh, I've been thinking about this for 6 years or 10 years. I'm going to do it now.
Now, maybe you've been procrastinating on assembling the right kind of earthquake kit yourself. And for some advice, we have Jacob Margolis, KPCC science reporter and host of our podcast, The Big One, Your Survival Guide. Hello, Jacob.
Hey.
I thought of you when the earthquakes happened.
I thought of you right away.
Yeah. Now, okay, so you've been reporting on earthquakes for a long time, and you always stress the importance of having an emergency kit, yet you still meet people who say they have not prepared one. What's stopping them?
I don't know. I think sometimes there's a psychological block that people see it as this sort of major thing that they have to tackle. You know, are you ready?
I'm more ready than I was before I met you.
Okay. Well, that's good.
That's good, right?
People need to realize that all they really need to do to get ready at the most basic is go buy water because you're going to need water.
That, yeah.
1 gallon per person per day. If you could have a couple weeks, that's great. If not, just start off with anything at all. Please have some food, first aid kit, all your medical documents.
Batteries, flashlight, all that stuff. I got it.
Yeah, because what's going to happen is if you're not ready, then you're going to have to rely on other people to help you. And those other people, there might not be a whole lot of other people to help you around, depending on where you are and how badly your area is hit. The best time to start preparing is when
Is now.
Go buy some water at Smart and Final, Costco, Walmart, whatever, like right now.
Now, if the big one is a really, really bad one, what does some level of preparedness do for a person?
It will allow you to. So one of the things that's going to happen that could very well happen is that, for instance, water mains could break and the pipes coming into your home could break, or the water could be contaminated and you need to treat it as contaminated, likely after a major earthquake. If you are prepared, you will then have water to drink. And that is really, really important, for instance. You will also feel, as you start to buy stuff, I was talking to my sister yesterday, and she was saying, you know, I actually went out and like bought all this stuff because of your podcast. And she's like, when the earthquake hit, and this is us, you know, patting ourselves on the back a little bit, but when the earthquake hit, she's like, I actually knew what to do, which was like get under a table, know that I have these supplies in this place, and I feel a little bit more prepared. And that was the hope. And you could please just go out now and buy some stuff.
Well, because, Jacob, one of the sentiments that I keep hearing is that, well, if it's a really bad one, like 8.0 or 9, it's like we're just in trouble. There's no amount of preparedness is going to help
that. We are in trouble, but do you want to be completely helpless and have absolutely no supplies and be absolutely just, you know, in a lot of trouble? Or do you want to, like, take that little bit of power you have and exercise it? Is this me like advocating for you to not? There's no both sides in earthquake preparation. Yeah. It is just one side, and that is you need to get ready.
Now, what if someone is planning to go on a long vacation? What should they do to make sure their house is in good shape when they get back in case the big one strikes while they're gone?
Yeah, you know, it's always good to have some sort of plan set up with your neighbors, and so they should know where your gas shutoff valve is. Besides that, you know, this typical stuff for vacation, making sure that maybe you don't have food left over in the fridge, because in case electricity goes out, you don't want it spoiling. All your trash is out, obviously, if you're going on vacation. But really figuring out those plans with friends and neighbors is really important. So, you know, maybe they can check on your place and shut off that gas if it does smell.
In 94, two houses down from my mom's house, a neighbor was on vacation. They had put their car under the carport. That carport collapsed and crushed their car.
So it sounds like a poorly built carport. I wouldn't necessarily just go park. I don't know, maybe a tree or a pole will fall down and crush your car in the street.
Now, okay, different ways to prepare if you have a disability, too. So what more should be on people's checklists?
Yeah, when you have a disability, depending on the disability, if your mobility is impaired or you are dependent on, say, on certain medicines, you have to make sure that you have backups of those medicines. If you have trouble getting around for any reason, make sure that you have there are people that you know that can come and help you out, that maybe you have an extra wheelchair, walker, cane, something like that stored somewhere so that if whatever you use is inaccessible, you know, someone's going to come and check in on you and knows where the secondary device is. If you use some sort of battery system, you should definitely have some sort of backup if you can. Although all of it gets very expensive. I mean, you should check in with your insurance to see what they cover.
Generators, though, because that's one of the things, keeping some medications cold. Everyone says, well, you got to have a generator.
Yeah, you should. I mean, diabetes, insulin needs to be refrigerated, and you should look into that.
Now, once I am prepared, how often do I need to refresh what's in that kit?
It depends on what it is. If it's batteries, look at the expiration date. If it's water, you know, I don't know.
That's the big thing, because everyone wonders about that.
Yeah, but what are you going to worry about? Your water leaching, like plastic leaching into the water? If this is an emergency situation, I'm either going to, like, you know, dehydrate to death or drink some not great tasting water. Yeah. I'm going to drink the not great tasting water as long as it's safe.
All right. Jacob Margolis, KPCC science reporter and host of our podcast, The Big One, Your Survival Guide. Jacob, as always, thanks a lot.
Thanks, A.
All right, as you've heard in news, President Trump is not taking no for an answer. Now, despite the U.S. Supreme Court blocking the citizenship question on the census and forms going ahead and being printed without the question on the census, the president is still considering his options to add that question in, which could include an executive order. We're going to hear how likely it is that he'll be able to pull it off in time when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us.
Podcasts are supported by Pepperdine's Graduate School of Education and Psychology, offering a master's in clinical psychology with an MFT. Their flexible evening format has locations in West LA, Encino, and Irvine, designed for working professionals and preparing graduates for licensure in both marriage and family therapy and professional clinical counseling. Attend an info session to learn more. Classes start September 3rd. Apply by July 8th for up to $6,500 in scholarships at gsep.pepperdine.edu.
Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Martinez. The plot thickens on the Trump administration's effort to put a new question on the 2020 census. It's a seemingly simple one. Is this person a citizen of the United States? Opponents say adding that question would lead to an undercount because non-citizens would be afraid to participate if they had to answer truthfully. Now, last week, the U.S. Supreme Court said the question cannot be on the census forms. The justices ruled the administration's reasoning was contrived. But a federal judge in Maryland gave officials until this morning to come up with a new reason. Here to break it all down is Rick Hassan, professor of law and political science at UC Irvine. Rick, welcome back.
Good to be with you.
Now, the Justice Department responded to that judge just minutes shy of the 11 a.m. deadline, our time. Did it give a new reason?
The Justice Department did not give a new reason. The Justice Department instead said, we may come up with a new reason later. But in the meantime, we don't think this lawsuit on whether or not the original reason was based on some kind of discriminatory intent should go forward. So you should really shut everything down. And since the Justice Department filed that, we actually had a response from the judge, and the judge said, no, our case on whether the original reason was discriminatory is going forward.
So just to be clear, we're going to come up with a new reason later. Forget about everything you've heard before today.
Exactly, which is not the kind of thing that the government usually says. The census questions usually take years to come up with. There's a whole process for coming up with a reason. The Justice Department came up with a reason. They said they were doing this to protect Hispanic voters under the Voting Rights Act. As you said, the Supreme Court said that was a contrived reason. And now, thanks to the Trump tweets, the Department of Justice and the Commerce Department are trying to see if there's something else they could say that might salvage the use of the question on the census.
Now, in the world of law, can the administration simply just tell a judge, you can't use anything we said before when it comes to considering this new reason? I mean, does the judge have to agree to that?
Well, certainly not, but it is a gambit that has worked in the past. And one example of this is, you may remember the travel ban. You remember we talked about the travel ban?
Yeah, yeah.
2.0, 3.0, and by the time we got to the final version of the travel ban, when it went to the Supreme Court, Chief Justice Roberts wrote an opinion, you know, also the person who wrote the opinion in the census case, and said, really, whatever reason may have been, whether the reason initially may have been discriminatory doesn't matter, because now the government's come up with a good reason for its latest version of the travel ban. One thing that's different here is the citizenship question is not changing, just the reason would be changing. Would the courts buy it? I'm quite skeptical given how botched this whole thing has been over the last couple of weeks. But it really may come down to a decision of the Supreme Court once again.
Could they change the way the question is phrased? Would that make a difference?
I think it's impossible to do that at this point because they've gone through this whole process. They have, you know, two options on the printing of the form. They're now printing the forms. I just read it's, you know, a couple of billion pieces of paper when you total everything up. They had two versions, one with the question, one without. Any question on the census goes through an elaborate pre-testing process. So, no, it's either include the question or exclude it.
We're talking to Rick Hassan, professor of law and political science at UC Irvine. Rick, what reasons did the administration give in the past to try and get that question on next year's census?
So the reason that was given was that in Voting Rights Act lawsuits that the government sometimes brings, when they are trying to help protect Hispanic voters have voting power that's protected under the Voting Rights Act, it would be helpful to have citizenship data. Now, it turns out that everyone who litigates these cases said, no, we have good enough data. We don't need this. And we now know that thanks to some documents that ended up getting leaked, that this was not the reason at all, and that, in fact, the reason was kind of the opposite of this. It was to give data that states could then use if they wanted to draw state or local or congressional districts excluding non-citizens, which is the kind of districting that would minimize the power of Hispanics and of Democratic voters. So kind of a 180 from what the Census Bureau actually said.
Now, looking forward a bit, this morning President Trump spoke to reporters next to his helicopter at the White House. He said that to get the questions on forms, he might use an executive order. Officials might try to add it as an addendum as well.
We could also add an addition on, so we can start the printing now and maybe do an addendum after we get a positive decision. So we're working on a lot of things, including an executive order.
Rick, legally, what can he actually do? Can he print the addendums? Can he use the power of an executive order here?
Well, he can try, but the thing is, there are two injunctions saying you can't print census forms with the citizenship question on it. So unless he's going to violate a court order and create a constitutional crisis, this seems to be kind of a very unusual way to try to deal with the problem. Usually you comply with what the courts say. And an executive order, I think, doesn't solve the problem of the Supreme Court saying you've got to come up with a real reason, not a pretext for including the question.
Say, Rick, this case goes back to the Supreme Court. Is it possible that the media coverage on this very controversial question will have already affected participation, even if it's not included on the official form?
Well, I think we're already seeing that you know, there's all of this talk about the census it being in disarray. There's talk about the citizenship question. And we know already that people who are not citizens are going to be less apt to want to answer the census because they're going to worry that the information could be used against them. Now, for privacy reasons, that information is supposed to be private for, I think it's 72 years. But with all of this talk from Trump and with all of this uncertainty, I think that already may be depressing census turnout, especially among the communities that are at issue when it comes to this citizenship question.
Rick Hassan, professor of law and political science at UC Irvine. You can find more of his analysis on the case at electionlawblog.org. Rick, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Switching gears, the California dream used to be a car and a house, but for some today, the dream is a car that is your house. Those are not people pushed by high rents to live in cars. They're people who choose it. They call it van life. As part of our California Dream collaboration, Capital Public Radio's Sammy Keola goes in search of the van life community.
Is it open? So I hop in with this guy. He goes by the name Travis Wild. We're in his shiny navy blue Dodge.
Yeah, so this is a bumpier hood. Like, this looks like a cool spot that I get back into, potentially.
He's been living in this van for about 3 years. He's constantly looking for a new campsite to call home. Tonight, he rolls up on a rocky bank near the South Yuba River and lets his dog out.
She's got a lot of energy to get out. It was probably a little less than 7 hours of driving to get here.
People in the van life share a big dream of living small and going places. It's taking off in California, where rising housing costs and a sense of adventure are inspiring more and more people to go wheels only. The first thing I notice about the inside of Travis's van is how comfortable and clean it is.
It's pretty simple.
His walls are pine, the floor is bamboo, his bed is surrounded by bookshelves, and a surfboard hangs from the ceiling. He shows me some space-saving tricks, like this hidden table that slides out.
From right here, just from under the bed.
Whoa.
And then continuing, just all of this is storage on the sides.
Travis is part of a community that's choosing the nomadic lifestyle, to save on rent, to live greener, or just because it seems like fun. But there's a whole other set of people who are forced to live in their vehicles because they can't afford housing. Sometimes these two groups join forces to fight local bans on sleeping in cars. Those are popping up in places like San Diego and Berkeley as more people go mobile. Voluntary van dwellers say they know it's a privilege, but it's not always easy. Vehicle maintenance, internet shortages, and even finding a place to use the bathroom can be a struggle.
There's always like these little kinks that are, at first it's like, oh, this is part of the adventure. And then you're like, oh, this is like, it's rainy and I have to stay inside here. A little bit more than I would have liked to.
None of this stops van lifers from doing their thing. Gabrielle Lewine is a grad student in psychology at the University of Southern California. She's researched millennials, their hopes and goals. She says some are rebelling against their parents' dreams.
Millennials are just questioning whether that's worth it. You know, it's a very traditional thing to think about. The primary thing you need is a roof over your head. In the same way that millennials are, to use the very trendy word of disrupting other kind of marketplaces, non-traditional living situations is, I think, just another piece of that trend.
Van dwellers tend to work remotely. They're artists, accountants, and web developers. The lifestyle is even generating its own microeconomy. Some travelers become social media influencers who make money by tagging gear companies on Instagram. Others run van life websites and apps. I stopped by to see Josh Thompson. He's converting a van into a mobile home right now. Country music plays as he measures out space for cabinets and other furniture.
So the bed will be up here, and this will be like kind of storage area for extra bike space, and then also just like climbing gear and whatnot.
He's getting pretty good at building these. Sometimes he sells the vans, but he's keeping this one for himself.
Like, life's pretty short, you know? It's just a minimal living that allows you like the freedom to make choices of what you do with your time and what you do with your money.
Travis says the same thing, that it's about freedom. That and the people he meets on the road.
It actually allows like face-to-face interactions, which are really important and becoming less and less common in today's world, I guess, is a big thing. Like, you can chat online all you want, but like, you'll really get to know somebody if you like, you know, have a couple beers around a campfire and go on a hike and like that sort of thing. That's really the fun part.
I say goodbye as Travis starts boiling noodles on his countertop stove.
So we'll get that going.
I notice a plank above the door, scribbled with a dozen signatures from friends who have stood right here. But tomorrow, like hundreds of other California vagabonds, he'll set out alone. In Yuba City, I'm Sammy Keola.
All right, as you're aware, I hope, it is the 4th of July weekend in Southern California. It's going to be sunny and picture perfect the next few days. So that means go outside, do something fun outside. Now, one of the places you can go to is a ballpark. The Dodgers are home this weekend versus the Padres. Now, one of the things about Dodger Stadium that's really interesting is how it was designed. It was designed way back in the 50s, built in the 60s, and it was designed to take advantage of our car culture. And one of the early ways, you could have driven right up to your box seat. Coming up, find out how when Take Two continues. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Martinez. In honor of 4th of July weekend, we wanted to revisit a conversation that's all about America's favorite pastime. Now, in the 21st century, plans for building America's ballparks involve entertainment beyond just sports. And that means, one, it has to appeal to as many people as possible, even non-sports fans. And two, it has to be a year-round destination spot, even if a team isn't playing there. Now, that's the plan in Inglewood, where the new stadium complex is being built for the Rams and Chargers. When that opens in late 2020, it'll be a venue not only for football, but also the Olympics, the World Cup, concerts, WrestleMania. It'll have shopping and dining options, too. Now, this idea of a stadium being all things to all people may seem like a new thing, but the beginnings can be traced back to the visionary businessman who brought the Dodgers to L.A. over six decades ago. Paul Goldberger gets into all that in his book released earlier this year. It's called Ballpark: Baseball in the American City. Here's our chat with Goldberger from a few weeks ago.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Now, Walter O'Malley was that visionary, and I think a lot of Dodger fans, Paul, know some of the basics. He pulled the Dodgers out of Ebbets Field and eventually built Dodger Stadium. But before we go east to west, tell us what O'Malley wanted to do in New York and the obstacles he faced there.
He had in mind a huge modern complex that would have encompassed not just baseball, but shopping, movies, underground parking in this enormous domed stadium that he wanted to build in downtown Brooklyn. And O'Malley correctly observed that Ebbets Field, you know, had not enough bathrooms, it had terrible facilities, it had steep, awkward aisles, narrow seats, and it was not located in an area that made expansion or renovation very easy. And so he saw it only as a relic to get rid of.
And how much did O'Malley want to design his New York ballpark to accommodate the automobile?
O'Malley really cared very much about making baseball work for a mid-20th century audience. And this was the time when nobody had quite figured out that there was a darker side to a world oriented entirely around the automobile. It all seemed like a bright new world right now. That was the time when Los Angeles was developing, people were moving to the suburbs, and the city seemed kind of old and tight and dark and crowded and difficult. And ultimately, that whole project fell apart, and it was not viable for him to really make anything work in New York.
All right, so all of O'Malley's plans in New York, as you mentioned, fall through. He decides to move the Dodgers to L.A. They play at the Coliseum while construction begins at Chavez Ravine. Mark, you write that this site, the Chavez Ravine site, more than any other, was a metaphor for what L.A. aspired to be at the time. Why?
Well, because it was accessible only by the automobile, but at the same time, it was relatively central and had the potential of kind of tying together the disparate parts of Los Angeles. In the late 50s, Los Angeles probably really was accurately described by the old cliche of a bunch of suburbs looking for a city. It didn't have that much that united it. Today, of course, even though it's even bigger, even more sprawling, and vastly more complicated, we also think of it truly as a great city. But it was a little harder to make that case then. The coming of the Dodgers in Dodger Stadium gave the city something to coalesce around symbolically that belonged to everybody, no matter what part of the city they lived in, no matter what their economic status, no matter what their ethnic background. Everybody could be a Dodger fan. Now, of course, Chavez Ravine itself has a very complicated and painful history, which is another story. But, you know, there was a very cohesive Latino community that was uprooted from there, initially in the early 50s to make way for a huge public housing project that ultimately did not go through. And then the remnants of it were uprooted to make way for Dodger Stadium when that was built, with great pain and enormous controversy, and in fact, a legal challenge that went all the way to the Supreme Court.
We're talking to Paul Goldberger. His new book is Ballpark, Baseball in the American City. Now, Paul, clearly in the Dodgers world, cars were king. Now, the aesthetics of the stadium. What local piece of architecture influenced how Dodger Stadium would turn out to feel?
Well, probably if there were any piece of architecture that influenced it, it would be Disneyland, really, and Tomorrowland of Disneyland. They wanted that sort of very Jetson-y feeling of that early 1960s feeling when everybody sort of thought the future was going to be wonderful and a little bit like a spaceship. And you do see little bits and pieces of that there. Now, of course, it has almost a quaint, old-fashioned feeling because it's a vision of the future that now is part of the past. But it also is very endearing, really, and very likable.
The two Walters, Walter O'Malley and then Walt Disney, they both wanted their venues to go beyond what we knew of ballparks and amusement parks of the past. It seemed like they both were of the same mind on this.
I think they were. I think both Walts understood something about serving customers or, you know, fans, patrons, whatever we call them, and wanted to make it easier and more attractive to them, knowing that they would come more often and knowing that we were entering the age of television also. And the only way to see baseball was no longer to go to a game. You could also stay home and watch it on television. So what would make the experience of coming enough fun and attractive enough to get you out of your house, away from your television, and into the ballpark? Well, the same things that Walt Disney was thinking about when he made Disneyland a place that people entirely at their own discretion, because no one has to go. It's not like having to go to school or having to go to the supermarket.
You say that, but there are some.
He made it, you know, made it a place that people would want to go. And similarly, you know, O'Malley wanted to make the ballpark a place that people would want to go.
While Walter O'Malley maybe didn't get everything he wanted in the design, the actual design has held up pretty well. Looking back, though, Paul, from its opening in 1962 to today, what was it able to contribute to the overall feel of the city of Los Angeles, Dodger Stadium as a structure?
I think Dodger Stadium as a structure underscored that sense of Los Angeles as a place of the modern that was looking to new ways of doing things. In a way, it became sort of like, you know, that theme building at LAX, that thing in the middle that doesn't serve any real function. I think it once had a restaurant, but now is just called the futuristic theme building. Dodger Stadium was kind of the same period and the same idea. It gave the whole city something to call its own.
Now, Dodger Stadium broke ground in 1959. L.A. in 2019 and beyond has a whole different set of problems than 60 years ago, Paul. So two questions. If Dodger Stadium were built today, how do you think it might be different?
Well, I hope the design of the stadium itself wouldn't be all that different because, as we've been saying, it's kind of cool looking and hard not to love. One thing that's really important to say, I think, is how beautifully the stadium in the last few years has been renovated and upgraded and improved in a way that is entirely supportive of that original design. Brenda Levin, the architect, and Janet Marie Smith, who's the executive of the Dodgers who oversaw the renovation, both sort of got it, and they said, we want to make this stadium work a little bit better today, but not compromise that idea. What I think would be really different, would have to be different, would be how it would connect to everything around it. You know, I think today we would make sure that it was connected to some component of the metro system. We would make sure that there were far more alternatives. It would be much better connected in terms of the street pattern and all that to the rest of the city. I'm not sure we would choose Chavez Ravine if we were building it today either. I mean, if you look at the extraordinary growth and development in so many parts of East LA in recent years, I mean, I can imagine areas of downtown like the Arts District being an amazing place for a ballpark, actually. Many, many parts of the city, there is the potential of something that actually is part of the whole pattern of streets, part of the whole urban fabric, and really could integrate into the city the way recent ballparks have done in so many cities. San Francisco and San Diego, in fact, you know, right here in California, have done that.
Paul Goldberger's new book is Ballpark, Baseball in the American City. Paul, thanks a lot.
This was fun. Thank you.
All right, you may have done all the typical holiday weekend things to do. Watched some fireworks, went to a movie, maybe shopped a few sales. But it's only Friday. You still have the rest of today and at least two more days and nights to go. And I know there's some stuff you haven't thought of yet. Lucky for you, we've got a curated list of where all the cool kids are going to be the next few days. Hear it when Take Two continues in 60 seconds. Stay with us. Crank up the beach, boys, baby. Don't let the music stop. We're going to ride it till we just can't ride it no more. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. For art lovers craving something outside the box, there's a show this summer with your name on it. The Pageant of the Masters in Laguna Beach is all about bringing famous and local works of art to life with real people. About 140,000 folks are expected to see the annual show. It opens on Sunday and runs through the end of August. Now, for an inside look, we bring you this report we first ran last year from KPCC contributor Audrey Ngo.
Picture this. It's a salty summer night in Laguna Beach, and people settle into a breezy amphitheater, wine in hand. The orchestra does a sound check. Living art is about to fill a huge picture frame on stage. It's all for Laguna Beach's annual Pageant of the Masters, a tradition that's been around for a few years now.
This is the 85th anniversary.
That's Diane Chalice, the director. Chalice says the idea for these living pictures came from Europe, way back.
In the 18th century, it was a parlor game to pose as a famous work of art. By the 1920s in Laguna, this was an activity that was a fun thing to do in your home, like a game of charades.
So in 1932, Laguna started its Festival of Arts with exhibits to celebrate the city's local art scene. But they needed a way to get butts in the seats, so to speak.
So they started doing a little sideshow called Spirit of the Masters, and they recreated works of art.
A few years later, Laguna resident Roy Ropp started directing the show. He worked in real estate and had a thing for painting landscapes and seascapes, and he went big, introducing music, narration, backdrops, and sets. Ropp also coined a new name, Pageant of the Masters. Fast forward to 2018, this year's theme is Under the Sun, a tribute to plein air paintings. For the art novice,
plein air is very simply painting in the open air.
That's Dan Dooling. He's written the pageant's narration for the past 38 years, and he could go on about Laguna's plein air painting culture.
Here in Southern California, where the light was so special, it made Laguna become a haven for artists who love to get out in nature and paint the seascapes, the groves of eucalyptus. In fact, one of the descriptions of the painters here in Laguna Beach were the eucalyptus school of plein air painters.
And every year, Dooling writes a segue to the pageant's long-standing final scene, Leonardo da Vinci's The Last Supper. You know, the one with Jesus and his 12 apostles sitting around the table at, well, the Last Supper. It's been the finale scene since 1936. And if you see past photos of the show, it looks exactly like an actual painting. In fact, some audience members bring binoculars, trying to see if performers blink or twitch. Richard Kassir knows that kind of pressure. He's been a pageant volunteer for 36 years. Kassir plays St. Thomas in Da Vinci's painting. Backstage, during a busy rehearsal, Kassir stands in a long gray robe, speckled on one side with yellow paint. He's also wearing a wig, beard, and some black thick-framed glasses. Not part of the costume. Kassir has seen generations of volunteers come back year after year.
I've seen girls that were in elementary school, now they're almost becoming grandmothers. So this is like a special family, a summer neighborhood that I love coming to.
The Last Supper is one of 38 pieces of art in the show this year. About 500 volunteers work on stage or behind the scenes, and that's because they've got to think about lighting, angles, makeup, headpieces, Everything has to be just right to look as close to the original artwork as possible. And the results have gotten a lot of attention. There's the classic episode of Arrested Development. The one where George Michael, the awkward teen, not the 80s pop star, was pegged to be in Michelangelo's Creation of Adam fresco, aka that painting on the Sistine Chapel ceiling. George Michael was a bit hesitant to wear Adam's anatomically correct costume for the pageant.
And George Michael finally saw the painting he was going to be recreating.
But codpieces aside, director Diane Challis says she wants the pageant to do what it did 85 years ago.
I hope that through seeing our pageant, that people will be more interested in art and the backstory about what sort of a person the artist was.
But it's not just the artwork. The pageant is about community coming together every summer to keep this colorful tradition alive. For Take Two, I'm Audrey Ngo.
Well, I'm down.
There's more to do than the pageant of the Masters. We have a whole bunch of ideas for this holiday weekend.
I'm Christine Ziemba from LAist.
And I'm KPCC's Leo Durand. Just because the fireworks have wonked out doesn't mean there isn't room for derbies, norteña music, and even more pride this weekend.
First, Everything is Terrible is a video and performance collective that's best known for creating these physical installations from its massive collection of Jerry Maguire VHS tapes. But now, the collective is opening a permanent home in L.A. They're throwing a party to christen its new East L.A. storefront performance space. So expect a night of video screenings, installations, music, plus food and drinks. The party takes place on Saturday night from 8 to midnight, and it's free to attend.
Also, Pride Month may be over, but many communities continue to host Pride events all year round. And for the first time, Compton is hosting one. It's tomorrow at Compton College. TV host James Wright emcees the event, and performances include Latinx rapper Figgy Baby, DJ Tila Storm, and more. There will also be food and drink vendors, and plenty of stuff for kids and families, too. And when you go, it's free.
This weekend, too, Golden Road Brewery in Glendale is holding an adulting version of the Pinewood Derby on Sunday. The second annual Beer Can Derby is a serious, okay, semi-serious racing event that pits miniature non-motorized kit cars in races throughout the day. The first place winner gets beer and prizes plus a trophy and eternal bragging rights. Racer check-in begins at 9 a.m. with the national anthem and the first races beginning around noon. The cost varies between $10 and $30.
Finally, keep the holiday parties going strong with some dancing. Tonight in Whittier is La Fe Norteña Siete, a music fest featuring the bandas La Fe Norteña, Se Azabeche, and more music from northern Mexico. This happens at the Pico Rivera Sports Center, and tickets are $30. Now, there's so much more to do this weekend. You can check out our full list of events on LAist.com. That is LAIST.com.
I'm Christine Ziemba from LAist.
And I'm KPCC's Leo Duran. And
have
see you later.
Have a good weekend, everyone.
All right, that's it for Take Two this week. The show was edited by Sue Carpenter. Our producers are Lori Galleretta and Austin Cross. Leo Durand directed the show and was also our senior producer this week. Emily Henderson helped out with some production. Tamika Adams is our news apprentice, and Brandon Young is our intern, the program engineered by Hazmik Pogosian. Now, if you missed any part of Take Two today or any part of the week, you can always find us all the time through our podcast, and that's available where you find your favorite podcasts and your favorite podcasting app as well. You can also find me on social media. I'm at Twitter at amartinezla. That's at amartinezla. And also on Instagram, same address, at amartinezla. That is for your social media convenience as always. All right. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two. We'll be back Monday at 2. Talk to you then.